Welcome. This is the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. This week, September 11th, 2025, we talk about new research and a review on hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, rehabilitation after myocardial infarction in older adults, the 2024 Marburg virus disease outbreak in Rwanda, and medications for opioid use disorder in county jails. A case report of a woman with dyspnea and fatigue, a medicine and society on the race correction debates, and perspectives on recent efforts toward equity, on medical research funding in a divided America, and on the end of days. Aficamten, or metoprolol, monotherapy for obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy by Pablo Garcia Pavia. From the Hospital Universitario Puerta de Hierro de Majadahonda, Madrid, and co-authors. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is the most common inherited heart disease worldwide and is associated with considerable disease-related morbidity. A substantial subpopulation of patients with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy have left ventricular outflow tract obstruction, for which the most common clinical consequences are symptoms that limit activities and reduce exercise capacity. Despite limited evidence of their efficacy, beta blockers have been used as the initial treatment for symptomatic obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Aficamten is a cardiac myosin inhibitor that reduces left ventricular outflow tract gradients, improves exercise capacity, and decreases hypertrophic cardiomyopathy symptoms when added to standard medications. This phase 3 trial evaluated whether aficamten as monotherapy could provide greater clinical benefit than beta blockers as monotherapy. 175 adults with symptomatic obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy were randomly assigned to receive aficamten plus placebo or metoprolol plus placebo. Among these patients, aficamten monotherapy was superior to metoprolol monotherapy in improving peak oxygen uptake and hemodynamics and decreasing symptoms. Adverse events appeared to be similar in the two treatment groups. Mavacamten in symptomatic non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy by Milind Desai from the Cleveland Clinic and co-authors. Currently, there are no approved medical therapies for symptomatic non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and frequently used off-label pharmacotherapies, including diuretic agents, beta blockers, verapamil or diltiazem, have limited efficacy as well as side effects. Mavacamten, a cardiac myosin inhibitor, is approved to treat adults with symptomatic obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. However, its effects in non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy remain uncertain. In this phase 3 trial, 580 patients with non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy were randomly assigned to receive mavacamten with dose adjustment on the basis of left ventricular ejection fraction or placebo with sham dose adjustment for 48 weeks. Among these patients with non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, mavacamten did not result in a significantly greater improvement in peak oxygen uptake or decrease in symptoms than placebo. Editorialist Amrut Ambardikar from the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus, Aurora, writes that the treatment of symptomatic hypertrophic cardiomyopathy remains a bifurcated track for two clearly disparate conditions, obstructive and non-obstructive. There are a wealth of treatment options for patients with obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and while additional questions remain regarding the optimal initial therapy and sequence of additional therapies, clinicians and patients can individualize care with an abundance of therapeutic options. In contrast, treatment options for patients with non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy remain poor. Development of novel therapies will be critical for improving treatment for those with this condition. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, a review article by Eugene Brownwald from Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is a complex, heterogeneous disorder that directly affects only the heart. It is characterized by hypertrophy of any portion of the left ventricular wall, frequently involves the basal interventricular septum, and is not explained by abnormal loading conditions or myocardial infiltration. Approximately 70% of patients with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy have subaortic muscular obstruction to left ventricular outflow that can be provoked or exacerbated by exercise or other stimulation of myocardial contractility. In hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, the left ventricle, especially the interventricular septum, is thickened, and the left ventricular ejection fraction is usually supranormal. Diastolic dysfunction slows ventricular filling. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is the most common monogenic cardiac disorder. Patients may be asymptomatic or may have heart failure, angina, or sudden cardiac death. Cardiac imaging tests, echocardiography, and cardiac MRI are important for the diagnosis and management. The prognosis is greatly improved by proven therapies, which include beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, cardiac myosin inhibitors, implantation of a cardioverter defibrillator, septal reduction therapy, and, if needed, cardiac transplantation. Multi-domain rehabilitation for older patients with myocardial infarction by Elisabetta Tonet from the Azienda Ospedaliero Universitaria di Ferrara, Italy, and co-authors. This study evaluated the benefit of rehabilitation interventions in patients 65 years of age or older with myocardial infarction and impaired physical performance. 512 older patients with impaired physical performance 1 month after myocardial infarction were randomly assigned in a 2-to-1 ratio to receive either an intervention consisting of management of cardiovascular risk factors, dietary counseling, and exercise training, or usual care. The multi-domain rehabilitation intervention resulted in a lower incidence of cardiovascular death or unplanned cardiovascular hospitalization within 1 year than usual care. There were no serious adverse events associated with the intervention. Marburg virus disease in Rwanda, 2024, Public Health and Clinical Responses, by Sabin Nsanzimana, from the Rwanda Biomedical Center, Kigali, and co-authors. On September 27, 2024, Rwanda reported an outbreak of Marburg virus disease after a cluster of cases of viral hemorrhagic fever was detected at two urban hospitals. These authors report on key aspects of the epidemiology, clinical manifestations, and treatment of Marburg virus disease during this outbreak, as well as the overall response to the outbreak. The results of epidemiologic investigations were highly suggestive of a zoonotic origin of the outbreak. An index patient was identified who had been exposed to Egyptian fruit bats at a mining site. The case fatality rate in the outbreak was 23%. Implementation of containment measures, advanced supportive care, and access to investigational countermeasures may have contributed to reduced mortality from Marburg virus disease in this outbreak. Medications for opioid use disorder in county jails, Outcomes After Release, by Peter Friedman, from Bay State Health, Springfield, Massachusetts, and co-authors. In 2019, seven county correctional facilities, jails, in Massachusetts initiated pilot programs to provide all FDA-approved medications for opioid use disorder, OUD. This observational study examined post-release receipt of medications for OUD, overdose, death, and reincarceration among 6,400 persons in carceral settings with probable OUD who did or did not receive medications for OUD from these programs from September 1, 2019 through December 31, 2020. The study found that receipt of medications for OUD in jail was associated with a greater likelihood of post-release initiation of medications for OUD and lower risks of overdose, death from any cause, and reincarceration than no receipt of such medications in jail. A 93-year-old woman with dyspnea and fatigue, a case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Suzanne Arnold and colleagues. A 93-year-old woman presented with 1 month of progressive dyspnea and fatigue that limited her previously active lifestyle. Her history included moderate aortic stenosis, atrial fibrillation flutter, chronic kidney disease, and osteoarthritis with bilateral knee replacements. Examination revealed a harsh systolic murmur without signs of fluid overload, and imaging showed coronary and aortic valve calcifications. There was no evidence of pulmonary edema. Laboratory testing demonstrated anemia, hemoglobin level 7.7 grams per deciliter, which improved with transfusion and resolved her dyspnea. Echocardiography confirmed progression of aortic stenosis, initially moderate, then severe, with a peak velocity of 4.1 meters per second, mean gradient 39 millimeters of mercury, and valve area 0.5 centimeters squared. The anemia was attributed to gastrointestinal bleeding consistent with Hayde's syndrome, the triad of aortic stenosis, gastrointestinal bleeding, and acquired von Willebrand's disease in the context of severe calcific aortic stenosis. The final diagnosis was symptomatic severe aortic stenosis with anemia secondary to Hayde's syndrome. The patient opted against valve replacement, favoring supportive care and eventual hospice if symptoms worsen. The race correction debates, progress, tensions, and future directions, a medicine and society article by Darshali Vyas from Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. In June 2020, the journal published these authors' call to reconsider the widespread use of race in clinical algorithms. Over the past 5 years, many race-adjusted clinical tools have been scrutinized and replaced with new race-neutral versions. These efforts have encountered obstacles and generated contentious debate about appropriate uses of race in medicine. The journal therefore asked the authors to review where these debates now stand. The race correction debates have showcased a necessary synergy between social justice advocacy and evidence-based rigor. They demonstrate that though the choice of what to study in medicine may be influenced by political movements, the ensuing investigations must be scientific. The reassessment of race adjustment exemplifies this balance. Advocates harnessed the momentum of a racial justice movement to call for a reevaluation of how physicians use race in tools and algorithms. Experts from various medical fields answered that call and launched efforts to ensure that physicians' tools are accurate and safe for patient care. The result is a more nuanced, rigorous approach to the use of race in clinical algorithms, an achievement for racial justice advocacy and evidence-based medicine alike. In this issue, we feature another series of cases published as part of our Efforts Toward Equity series. Caring for Patients with Intellectual or Developmental Disabilities, a Curriculum for Residents, a perspective by Lauren Clark from Stanford University School of Medicine, California, and co-authors. Recognizing that doctors lack confidence in caring for patients with intellectual or developmental disabilities, IDDs, a Stanford residency program and a local service organization created an introductory curriculum. In their pilot program, the curriculum was taught during a single lunch hour didactic session. Data from 41 internal medicine residents who attended the didactic session and completed surveys showed that after the session, residents felt more confident in their ability to meet the stated session objectives, which included recognizing best practices of working with patients with IDDs, recognizing disparities in access to care for patients with IDDs, recognizing issues in the healthcare system related to legal guardianship, that is, consent to treatment, privacy, and HIPAA-related issues, using inclusive language and terminology for patients with IDDs, listing systems of non-clinical services and supports that might be useful for patients with IDDs, and providing high-quality clinical care to a person with an IDD. Diaper need, an under-recognized social driver of health, a perspective by Winter Berry and co-authors from the University of New York Upstate Medical University, Syracuse. About 46% of families in the United States and 62% of the patient population attending the author's clinic lack sufficient funds to change their children's diapers as often as necessary. The Upstate Pediatric and Adolescent Center, a patient-centered medical home at SUNY Upstate Medical University, in collaboration with the Central New York Diaper Bank, sought to address diaper need. The primary care clinic serves more than 11,000 families. During well-child visits, any family with unmet need receives 50 diapers. A 2023 regional survey with 1,742 respondents revealed that after receiving the diapers, 70% of caregivers reported reduced stress, 80% felt like better parents, 69% could buy non-food essentials, 70% could buy more food, 79% felt their babies were healthier, and 76% could pay another bill. Improving care coordination for Indigenous patients with cancer, a perspective by Amanda Janitz and co-authors from the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences, Oklahoma City. The American Indian and Alaska Native population has the highest incidence of cancer in the United States. Despite high cancer-related mortality, health systems serving American Indian and Alaska Native populations offer only primary care. The University of Oklahoma is bridging the gap with a coordination and communication program for patients with cancer. The program's navigators served 128 patients in their enhanced program from July 2023 through February 2025. The percentage of patients who missed appointments decreased from 19% to 11%. Depression screening rates increased from 72% to 100%. The top three areas of need were transportation, lodging, and completion of advanced directives. 68% of these patients received direct support to address financial barriers to care. Health and medical research funding in a divided America. How to increase support. A perspective by Robert Blendon from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, Boston, and co-authors. Two separate debates are going on nationally about the current U.S. administration's substantial reductions in federal funding for many major universities. The first is whether federal funding should be reduced for universities because their educational programs are perceived as too liberal and they are seen as insufficiently responsive to anti-Semitism on campus. The second debate is over whether federal government funding to support medical and scientific research conducted at universities should be substantially reduced. A majority of U.S. Republicans support withholding federal funding from ultra-liberal universities, but maintaining medical research funding. To the authors, this finding suggests a need for a focused national campaign to educate members of the public about the critical importance of university health science research funding for the lives of people in their communities. The authors discuss the specific strategy such a campaign would require to succeed. The End of Days, a perspective by Isaiah Thomas from the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, Boston. On her first day on the psychiatric unit, the patient said her throat had closed up a few years ago. She couldn't eat for a month. The patient sat with Dr. Thomas and the attending in the unit's cafeteria. She didn't see the point in trying anymore. She didn't trust the school system anyway, or the government, or society. Everyone just went about their lives, never doing anything, while the world burned around them. Dr. Thomas wrote, "Paranoia," on his notepad, then added a question mark. The patient was a high school freshman with recent diagnoses of major depression and generalized anxiety. Things had worsened for the patient in the past few months. She worried about the environment, climate change, disasters of our own making. The idea that this all could be gone within her lifetime, she didn't know how to cope. She had been in therapy and started an antidepressant, but after a week, everything became too real, too much reality for her to bear. So she came to the hospital. The attending and Dr. Thomas wanted to try a medication to slow down her runaway thoughts. The patient was willing to try it. On the first day after starting the medication, she said she had no thoughts in her head. Her mind was empty. On the second day, she had total clarity about what she must do. She had to die. It was the only logical answer. She was nothing more than a carbon footprint. They decided to see how tomorrow went. On the third day, she woke up and no longer felt she needed to die. She wondered aloud if it was the medication giving her hope. But it wasn't just the pill. It was all of them in that room trying together. Whether her symptoms represented mental illness or, in the words of psychiatrist and social critic Thomas Saz, a sane reaction to an insane society, the core remedy was the same. Building connections and making meaning. In our images in clinical medicine, a 42-year-old man presented with an expanding asymptomatic rash on his trunk. Examination showed multiple papulosquamous plaques on the torso and a larger patch with central clearing and peripheral scaling on the left side, typical of pityriasis rosea. Another image shows an acute epididymo-orchitis in IgA vasculitis. A 5-year-old boy with IgA vasculitis presented with scrotal swelling and pain and worsening of his leg rash. The physical examination showed purpura on the legs and swelling, erythema, and tenderness of the right scrotum. A third image shows a ruptured pulmonary hydatid cyst. A 16-year-old girl presented with a 2-month history of cough. Chest x-ray showed a well-circumscribed cystic lesion containing another rounded structure, creating a double-domed appearance at the base of the left lung. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.